Welcome to the Conversations with a Coach podcast. I'm your host, Tanya Filer, and I'm a mindset and life coach and lover of great conversations. Some of the ideas, beliefs, and opinions you hear discussed on the podcast might not align with your own, but I would like to challenge you to stay curious and open-minded. If you can do that, you can find value in any conversation and create new perspectives. Thanks for listening. I appreciate you. Hello, welcome back to the Conversations with a Coach podcast with me, your host, Tanya Filer. Today's episode is with my good friend, Dan Osman. And Dan is somebody that works within the health and fitness space as a coach. And in today's conversation, we cover things like unconscious bias, social pressures, social media pressures, the middle ground. This is a topic that we talk about quite extensively on this podcast, that nuanced middle ground where not a lot of people like to admit they sit. What we love and hate about the fitness industry. And there are some uncomfortable conversations within this episode. So this is a little bit of a trigger warning for you. There are some topics here that might cause you some stress when listening. So this is just a small trigger warning for you. Have a look at the show notes for a little bit more detail. But I hope you really enjoy today's episode. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. My guest today is somebody that I have an awesome amount of respect for and is lovingly and affectionately known as the nicest man in fitness. My guest today is Dan Osman. Welcome, Dan, and thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for the invite. Honoured to be asked, and I'm pretty sure that you're the only person that calls me that. My ego thanks you.
There's definitely at least five other people that always
my mum, my sister, my wife.
Amazing. So how are you?
I'm all right. That's the honest answer. I was going to think of a good lie. I'm all right. I think it's important to be honest. I was going to give you the I'm fine, I'm good, but I'm all right today.
Excellent. It's always good to have somebody that understands that the question is coming from a place of genuine, like, interest rather than just the standard. How are you? You all right, mate?
Yeah, that's why you got a genuine answer.
Yeah,
I know that.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. So can you, for the people that don't know who you are, and there will be some because...
Many.
Tell us about the work you do and what led you to focus on people's mental well-being as well as their physical health.
The work I do, I'm a mongrel of health is how I describe myself these days, because I've been coaching in some shape or form for about 17 years now. And that originally started as wiping sweat off the machines as a level 2 health and fitness instructor to doing my PT qualifications. I worked in strength and conditioning for a little while. I worked in performance nutrition for a bit. I've done some writing. I've done some speaking. I don't really know what I do these days, but I still work with people. So fundamentally, understanding the complex apes that we are is fascinating to me. I want to know what makes people tick. And having learned a lot about what I would call the science of coaching and understanding a bit more about optimals and the best things for people, that's what the textbooks say, tell us, that's what the studies tell us. All of that's irrelevant unless we have more of an understanding of the psychology of people. And that comes with their biases, their experiences, and everything else that feeds them, the challenges that they face every day. And that's what, I guess, for want of a better word and buzz phrase, mind comes into it, because it is those ingrained sets of beliefs that people have about themselves, which often limit them. It's not this elitist thing, especially in the space. So I guess these days I do work more closely with people. It's less to do with macros and optimal exercise choices for them towards a specific goal, but I'd like to think more closely aligned with their personal values and the non-direct things that kind of get in the way of people making progress, you know, being effective with communication themselves, recognizing certain facets of their life that aren't necessarily helpful to them, but patterns they've got into which they feel they can't escape. So how do I help people? Their understanding of themselves, I think, initially, but that comes through learning a little bit more about them and what makes them tick, because, you know, I think the optimals are often referred to is we know that stuff works, but getting people to adhere to that stuff and actually embrace behavior change is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, completely. Because we can see through social media, obviously, and our own lived experiences, particularly women of a certain age, and now young guys as well, that improving how we feel and improving how we want to look, it's been portrayed as a kind of one-size-fits-all fat loss, gym bro, cardio bunny, starve yourself solution, like a one-stop solution. So when people start to understand when they're working with you that this stuff is individual, like everybody's reasons for being the way that they are. And you mentioned the word biases. So how do our biases, what are biases and how do they impact how we feel and how we behave?
I mean, often our thoughts about ourselves, especially are ingrained into us from a young age. That goes down to our, you know, our most core and ingrained values from when we're, you know, we have an understanding of our impact on the world. And simple phrasing like one that I'm often having to nag my mum about, unfortunately, is little things like reminding my daughter how beautiful she is. I don't want her to see her only value in the world on her appearance. So already, if a child that small, as young as 5, 6, is getting lots of praise based on their appearance, then it makes total sense that they're going to be valuing that above all else. But what we do societally, I think, is that we applaud the less important things, I think, on a personal level. And that's my belief. That's my biases. But my biases are built, and what I understand now, from less helpful things I often learned when I was a bit younger. So material wealth, for example, the bottomless void, the goalposts are constantly moving there. Outward appearance, you know, everyone's got their own relative version of success. So when we talk about biases, I think that feeds into often the we're a byproduct of our environment and these external things that we've been subjected to, such as programming. This is what makes you wealthy. This is what leads to happiness. This is what leads to success. But we don't often encourage people to tap into themselves from a self-awareness point of view, which the contradictory and often interesting thing about self-awareness is you almost need a level of self-awareness to become a little bit more self-aware. So lots of us with our own self-serving
paradox.
Our self-serving narratives, our self-serving biases, aren't even aware of them because they are just us. And we all often hear that when you have conversations with people, oh, I'm just that way, because their belief is it's immovable. I'm not capable of change. This is just the way I am. So I think, to use that buzz phrase again, when doing mindset work and especially exposing people's biases, is making them aware of things like neuroplasticity, and that we have these ingrained sets of beliefs that get us used to traveling in certain ways with our thoughts, but we can reroute that. You know, we can practice that. We can change that. And everyone is capable of change, but helping people understand that is a little bit more difficult. And I think, you know, what you were talking about before, when we talk about logical thought, especially, is that when something's so emotive for people, especially with their beliefs about themselves, and just to use an example, the message behind fat loss, for example, and that being, you know, you have fat, you are not fat. From a logic standpoint, that's 100% true. But if you're trying to tell someone that from an emotional standpoint has led a lifetime believing that fat makes them less of a person, that fat has all these negative connotations, logic doesn't really come into it. I think that's the gap that we have with people sometimes. So not just being aware of our own biases, but making others aware of their own, but they've got to be receptive to that. And that's that double-edged sword of self-awareness sometimes. And that, a rubbish analogy has just come to head because I'm a total geek for superheroes, is like Superman, for example, when he is a boy and he first discovers his powers, everything's really heightened. But with age and experience, you have to learn how to turn the volume down, become more attuned to certain things. So when we become more aware of other people's biases, it's not my job and the work that I do with people to point those biases out. It's leading down a path that they, you know, it highlights them, that to them, that's when they make the choice to change that behavior if they want to.
Yeah, because I think it's very easy to refer back to logic all the time, and we're all capable of logical thought. We all know that if we eat too much of that, it's going to have a negative impact on our health. That's easy. It's the emotional aspects of that. We are driven by feelings, thoughts, behaviours, and like you said, the biases. So whenever anybody says to me that, oh, this is just logical, like it's logic, why can't people understand this? I like want to strangle them because we're humans and we're capable of logical thought, but that's not how we operate. Operate from our emotional aspect the whole time. If we didn't, I don't know what the world would be like. But you can see it play out everywhere. Like, social media is like my market research playground with this, and you can see that everybody responds and reacts from a place of emotion, not from a place of logic.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an interesting concept.
There's a good reason, and an example I'll give of someone that I know, which I won't mention their names or anything, but they've been quite closely associated with my family for years. And the lady in question, her mother died of lung cancer. She had a load of other ailments that she lost her life to that eventually. And the lady now, she still smokes 40 a day. She's had a heart bypass. She's been warned of her susceptibility. I think there's a good general consensus that smoking isn't a good thing to do for your health, but she still continues to smoke. And that's not because of logic. That's because arguably smoking serves a different purpose. It's an addictive substance, but logic doesn't come into that conversation. There is no logic.
No.
And I think that acts almost as a frustrating element of that conversation on both sides. Because if you're very logically, rationally minded, there can sometimes be almost like an empathy gap.
Yeah.
If you're relatively limited by your world experiences and you don't know other people that have experienced things similar, you're banging your head against the wall thinking, why can't I get through to this person? Everyone's experience is their own. And
yeah.
I think that's where it's getting to know people comes into
it. That's why communication is super important. It's understanding somebody else's version of language, and language isn't just the words that we use, it's the tonality and our, like you just said, logical thought versus emotional, rational argument. And social pressures. So if we go back to what you were saying earlier, what we were saying about social media, do you see social pressures like social media content, family, peers? Do you see social pressures impacting the people that you work with? Is that part of the struggle that they have when it comes to wanting to be their best self?
I think so. And I think if we're being entirely honest about this conversation, it's something that impacts us all. So despite knowing better, I could confidently say it probably affects me at times. It does. Like, we've spoken, I'm on a little social media hiatus at the moment, not for any specific reason. I was just fascinated in terms of what that will do for productivity, personal relationships outside. Can I make time to, we was talking about reading a physical book over actually just reading stuff off a screen, you know, writing a little bit more, because I think reading is a great way of expanding your thought processes and exploring it, but learning how to articulate that and put that into your own written hand is quite interesting as well. And then being able to teach that to someone else or share that with someone else is a whole nother experience. But if you're constantly living through your screen and experiencing much of the world 2D, because essentially it is two-dimensional, we're almost learning how to get on with people. We're learning their sense of priorities in life, trying to learn their own motivations. And also, I think there's a self-deceptive element of ourselves sometimes and our motives, that we think our motives are pure when we do certain things. But is altruism truly altruistic if you want to be recognised for altruism? Like people that take pictures of themselves with a sandwich, giving it to a homeless person, putting it all on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
There's an element of self-deception there. But I think it affects us all, because it's our new reality. Our reality is what we most expose ourselves to. And if our reality is skewed because of we largely live a lot of our life through our screens, I think there are some studies into generationally how much time people spend on their phones these days. And I think you and I, it might be something like up to 4 to 5 hours. But for the generation, there's 9 years between my sister and I, it's probably close to 8 hours. Obviously, that's not in one chunk, but just those little intermittent glances at the phone, then, I think that, of course, that's going to negatively impact all of us or skew our perceptions on what success, what happiness is.
Yeah, and these are the social pressures that can affect how we see ourselves, our relationship with ourselves, and our relationship with our immediate family and friends, is that we have this perception that friendship looks like this because that's what I've consumed on a regular basis, or a good relationship or a loving relationship should involve XYZ because this is the content that I've been consuming since I was XYZ. As a parent, I know, so my kids are 20, 16, 8 and 6, so I've got varying ages. So the 20 and 16 year old are obviously social media savvy. They use social media. I'm quite, not strict, but I'm conscious of having conversations around content that they might be seeing or content that I see, particularly recently with my son. I had a conversation with him about Andrew Tate, Cobra Tate.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of him, yeah.
Hustlers University. We won't go down that route too much, but I was conscious that Sam was seeing this guy's stuff. And I was like, so what do you think? What's your opinion of this guy? And he said, it's just a joke, isn't it? It's not serious. He's just playing a character. And I was like, I'm glad that that is what it actually is, because I was concerned that he might be absorbing it and taking the perspective of this guy is successful, he's loaded, these are the things he says, and therefore that's what I want to emulate. And I think it's really important that we recognize, like you were saying earlier, do you think our biases are influenced more by social media than by our family and peers these days?
I think that'd be accurate. I think that'd be accurate, you know, from a, I guess if we're talking about a logical perspective, and that is where we spend most of our time, because our environment's changed. We don't spend most of our time with our family and friends. We spend most of our time in, air quotations, work. And if you work in this space, work does involve a certain amount of time on social media. So you're going to be subjected to a certain amount of messaging, which I have no understanding of algorithms, but I, from my understanding, might be that they push stuff that you either vehemently are against or you're passionately in support of. So it's easy to get caught in a rut of being in an echo chamber and us and them mentality. And we see that all the time. It's like an in-group created to challenge an out-group. So when you're of that world, and you know what we, I think what we'd want from anyone, and we're talking about growth of mindset and things like that, is the ability to think for yourself. But if you're only exposed to the same things over and over again, I think of course that shapes your beliefs on things, especially when most people don't have that, again, that self-awareness thing, is most people aren't aware of that, you know. And if they're constantly clicking on Andrew Tate videos over and over again, oh, that's a Jordan Peterson video, I'll go have a look at that, that's a so-and-so video, I'll have a look at that. And then it's language that I wouldn't necessarily agree with, or I wouldn't, a thought process I wouldn't encourage of people, that becomes normalized for those individuals. Misogynistic, slight of tongue, and you know, all these sort of things that, that becomes that person's normal. So when they're challenged with that, I think by most of us that it's natural to push back a little bit. And I believe this, why don't you believe it as well? Because, and again, an age thing maybe, is that at certain points in of our lives, we expect everyone to be on the same page as us. Whereas I think it's healthy to disagree with people. It doesn't necessarily mean falling out with them, but just having differing opinions. So I consciously, I do try to expose myself to stuff and people I know, I don't necessarily agree with everything they have to say. I listen to Joe Rogan podcasts occasionally. Not because
I do occasionally.
Not because I, you know, I like Joe Rogan as a comedian, but his political thoughts and thoughts on things that are going on in the world, without being specific, I don't necessarily agree on, but he gets some interesting characters on there. Now, it's not necessarily to change my mind, but it's, I guess, to see the other side of the conversation.
I think that's really important that when we, I spoke to Cathy McDonald about this on a previous episode, that I intentionally will seek out social media stuff where there is a topic for discussion. It's normally like world events that are happening, and I will seek out the person in there that has the extreme opposing a view to me. And I will ask them, why is it that you believe that? What is it that makes you believe that? I'm curious, because I think it's important to understand people's perspectives and what their purpose is. And it's really interesting to find that our purpose for our belief is generally the same.
Yeah.
Like we are looking for the same result from this opinion. And it's fascinating how that opposing view can be vehemently distressing or disturbing for us, but that person is wanting the same outcome as you. Fascinates me.
Yeah.
It really does.
I think it's from a genuine perspective, but unfortunately within that, and that's that self-deception thing, I think people have an idea of what they're pursuing and the sort of content they're putting out. We're not, realistically, it is clickbait. It's to generate a reaction, not necessarily because they care that much about what they're talking about. You know, the amount of people I've flippantly heard talk about trans things, you can see that, you know, that they've got no, they've gone out, they haven't gone out of their way at all to learn anything about this issue, but they have hold very strong opinions about that because they know that's going to get engagement. And they might be an individual that says, oh, you know, I'm open to debate, I'm open to be challenged by it. But it's more like this virtuous thing is it's, I'm happy with people viewing me as this individual that is open to being, to having a debate or being virtuous. But actually, when it comes to doing it, you see them lash out at people on their stories. This person said that, they're an idiot. They're not open to those conversations. I guess not even high profile people, but certain people I think I would be able to have those conversations with before. And in the most respectful sense, I don't believe the comments is always the most appropriate place to do that. But if I know them personally, I might drop them a message and you just don't get a response. So it's like, which one are you? Are you open to debate here, or you're open to debate providing you can change my mind and coerce me into your way of thinking? Because that's not how debate works.
No, and it's prolific. Like, we see it happening all of the time. What impact do you think social media has on men specifically and their relationship with themselves? Body image, for example.
I think men are subjected to now what women have been for centuries. You know, that's changed somewhat, whether it was wearing corsets in the 1800s. If someone's totally knows the history there, I'm saying the 1800s because that's my belief. It might go back before that. Don't quote me on the 1800s, but you know what I mean. A long time ago, to like the thin ideals of the 90s, where less than zero sized models, like the more the Kardashian era. So I guess like the female body image ideals have evolved and changed. I'm not even going to say evolved. I don't think evolved is the right word, because that almost suggests that they've got better. They've just changed. Whereas the classic male archetype has been pretty similar throughout. It's always been, you look back at Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, for example, the gentle with the eight limbs, or Michelangelo's David, or any depiction of a Greek god, or any depiction of a superhero. They're all jacked. They're all muscular. That's what you grow up idolizing as a man. And that is in our face more so now, you know, every depiction of, and it's this contradictory messaging around mental health, especially because it's something I'm curious and fascinated about, is almost the way these images are portrayed now is it, by looking this way, this has benefited my mental health. And that might be true on some scale, but almost the suggestion is same with body transformations, suggesting that people are ultimately happier, or that's them at their physical and healthiest, is that people, men especially, are now looking to achieve a certain physical appearance to rectify what they feel it might be going wrong, in air quotations, that no one will see, in, you know, from a listener standpoint.
Yeah.
So I think men are subjected to more. I think they're getting more than their fair share. But again, there's some cognitive dissonance in that the stuff that we recognise, and same with social media, the stuff that we recognise isn't necessarily helpful to us. We still applaud it. We still, you know, position it on a platform. Everyone, every single year. And look, I'm not being a bore with this. I just don't watch Love Island myself. It's just not, you know, I'm not on board with it. What anyone chooses to do with their free time is absolutely fine. But every year we acknowledge the problematic aspects of that feeding into certain body image ideals for men and for women. Yet every year there's another season. Every year it's more provocative anymore. Every year it's more suggestive. Everything is that much more sexualized. So it's the, I'm going to acknowledge there's a problem with this. Also, I know from a capitalist point of view, I can make a bit of money from this.
Yeah, that's the uncomfortable, distressing part of this realization and awareness.
Coaching. We will look at body transformations. How many coaches will acknowledge the problematic aspects of a grey, seemingly miserable, black and white picture of someone with an upside down frown? No, that's not the correct phrase. A frown, not the upside down bit. Like protruding stomach, them seemingly unhappy, or their version of their unhappiness. It's a 12 weeks later, airbrushed, photoshopped image of themselves. Look, I'm fixed.
Yeah.
But then they will be selling another body transformation a few weeks down the line. Because that's what sells. Yeah. That's what makes money.
It is. It's the sexy stuff, isn't it? It's like when you were talking about the work that you do and how you help people. This isn't the stuff that we see being marketed or promoted as the solution for.
Can I be fully transparent? I actually don't even know how to market what I do these days, because it is so unsexy.
We've had that chat. Yeah, we've had that chat before.
It's so, there are so many untangibles or intangibles attached to that. You know, you can't, especially on social medias, you can't, from a business standpoint, apart from testimonials or videos, which we all know everyone doesn't have the attention span for, to either one, read, or two, watch a proper testimonial video. is how do you get yeah. across? You know, someone could have had a work promotion. They could be the happiest they've ever been. They could be enhanced their relationship with food. They could be not caught up on this debilitating obsession with their body to the point that they can't go out and socialize. But I haven't got a picture for that, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And it is such a problem when social media has become the vehicle for getting your message out about the great work that you do. But we know that the platforms are set up to make you respond to certain types of content. And the conditioning that we've had for the last God knows how many years means that we can, because of our bias, our unconscious bias, we can just passively be liking the content that's problematic without even being aware of it. So we will see the before and afters.
Place it higher up that ladder of priority so it pushes it to more people. And I think that there's a greater societal issue in that societally we reward the least favourable aspects of human behaviour. I think, you know, glorified, I'm not even saying wealth, but greed. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money, I think, but greed, capitalist greed is glorified. Extreme bodies, which are less than healthy, extreme procedures. Yeah. And this isn't a judgment on anyone that's had any sort of procedure to make themselves feel better about themselves. But I'm talking like the thousands and thousands have spent, is essentially, what's the correct phrasing? Body modification. Because it's not just cosmetic surgery. It's you look at these BBLs now, you look at breast augmentations, you look at things, you know, and again, I think there's a level and it's what people are happy with. But when you've got that paired with photoshopping, paired with social media filters, it's just not a true reflection, is it?
It's impossible for people to accept their own appearance, personality, situation or culture and environment.
But again, it's that contradictory thing because we acknowledge it, but we reward it. And we, you know, socially we reward it. Social media, we certainly reward it. How well do those most cruel, callous, unkind call-out videos do? They go viral. People love them.
Yeah.
And is that, I don't know, again, this is my biases. That isn't necessarily a behavior I'd encourage in my daughter, calling someone names, giving strong opinions. Because there's this... that author, I don't know whether you're aware of him, Paul Bloom, has a saying that it's entirely unreasonable to be too empathetic, which I think it is.
So that's the guy who wrote Empathy. I've read it on your recommendation. It's on my nightstand upstairs. I can't remember the title of it. What's the title of it? Remind me.
What is the title? I forget it. It's got empathy in the title. But his suggestion is that almost that the investment in being too empathetic is almost we get caught up in that, and it's very much right. Marketing is how we might see things that feed into certain charities on programs, for example. It's based around an individual, their plight, their struggle, because we can resonate with that. We can be empathetic towards that. If it's built around the masses and the broader message, we buy into that less. So what his suggestion basically is, without me waffling on, is that to be too empathetic is entirely unreasonable. But what we actually mean is we're being compassionate. And from a compassionate standpoint is we have the ability to be a little bit more objective, accept the facts and the information, the, you know, informed choices that we have, and broadly understand how certain things benefit people and others don't. You know, much of the messaging around the obesity situation, for example, obesity and health is, I think, I certainly buy into the ethos that you can't assume someone's health status based on their appearance. You can't. But within context of certain situations, and just pulling a random example out of the sky, is that if an individual is morbidly obese, they are encountering a few health issues, and you have an understanding that they don't engage in health behaviours in any shape or form. They are a smoker. You know, they live in a socioeconomically deprived area. You can make an educated guess. But what the messaging from anti-diet especially will revolve around is, this is a picture of me, I do exercise, are you saying I'm not healthy? I'm not saying that. We're saying broadly the suggestions, and how we get that messaging across is really important. But then you'll also see the flip side of that. And we love to live in the extremes is an individual that hasn't experienced any necessarily negatives or their perception of negatives being 5% body fat and glorifying that. But we know categorically that the majority of people that get to those single digit body fat numbers, not the genetic outliers, are taking an incredible amount of drugs, are living a life deprived, they are having other health issues. So, yeah, we're so far removed, I think, but we applaud it still. We applaud it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, because there's not enough people that are talking loudly or collectively in that nuanced middle area because it's boring.
Yeah.
It's not sexy. Yeah. It's practical and it's sensible, right? Nobody wants to talk. When it comes to social media and media in general and anything that needs to be discussed on a wider scale, you have to belong to one camp or the other. You have to pick a side, whether that's politics, whether that's health, any size, anti-diet, whether it's freedom of speech or self-censorship. You have to pick a side. Whereas I was listening to an Africa Brooke podcast this the other day.
She's great.
I love her. I really do love her. She is like my podcast dream guest, maybe in 12 seasons time. But that nuanced bit in the middle is where most of us live and believe and discuss things. We don't necessarily form strong opinions either way, but it doesn't translate to an interesting social media post or an interesting documentary. We're geared up to be controversial and to pick a side when it comes to this stuff.
For some, so, is never an interesting message. You know, like tracking your calories. No. Are you at risk of developing eating disorder? Some people are, but that's not everyone.
Yeah.
Okay, but can you tell me, like, will I develop it? I can't tell you because it depends. And we're not satisfied with it depends. We love to live in the extremes. And I think the majority of people day to day, and this is the other thing about social media, it detaches you from real life connections. Most people do live in the middle. They do, realistically.
Yeah.
But what we're exposed to on social media is the extremes. A lot of people don't actually think that way. We tend to take what we see on social media as reflection of everyone, when it's not. It's just the ones with the loudest voices, the ones that have the biggest, the ones that have a blue tick.
Yeah, empty vessels make the most noise. That's the saying, isn't it, or something? And with that in mind, tell me something that you love, because I want to bring it back round to some positivity.
Oh, if I hijacked it, made it too negative.
Not at all. No, this is the extremes, right? And the bit in the middle. What do you love about your industry?
I love, even the mistakes that people make, it comes from the purest place. And I think there is a genuine desire to help as many people as possible, even if there isn't an acceptance that you can help everyone. We give it a good crack, you know.
Yeah.
I'm more than happy to refer people out. I think that's an important kind of underrepresented thing in our industry, because I think that serves us all. You know, I'd much rather refer someone to another practitioner I know that they could really benefit from them, come with me and have a bad experience. I think that comes from a work scarcity thing, because it is a fairly young industry still. We're all still learning. And I see that as a positive.
Yeah.
We are still learning. And I think what I would love to see more of is what we were talking about before we were recording, is just the ability to get stuff wrong, but not, you know, without punishment. I don't mean by punishment, because some people go out of their way to be wrong and stir up a reaction. But if I use incorrect language or something that's particularly triggering to someone, is I don't want to be cancelled, but I do want the ability to go, I'm really sorry about that. I had no idea. But and learn from that, because how else are we supposed to learn if we can't make mistakes?
Yeah. Yeah. Curious questioning, isn't it? That ability to the courage to get it wrong. A lot of people, they wouldn't ever in a million years consider referring somebody out for a service, because it's an admission that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
And some people aren't happy with feeling less than perfect or out of their depth. It's an ego-based thing.
But we've had this culture, and we still do, especially with call-out culture and people going on doing these reaction videos where they call someone an idiot, whereas I'd be horrified, you know, if I made a joke. And there were extremes of that payment that let you know, like the Liver King and his videos on eating testicles or eating raw meat and things like that. Some people are the extreme end of that, but I'd much rather just have a conversation about with someone about something I could have done better. And I think if there was less fear about getting stuff wrong, it would level everyone up. But everyone else,
yes,
and you know, everything is recorded infinitely on social media.
That's
so you can't get away from mistakes.
When I was young and making mistakes all the time, nobody knew, because unless you had a 110 film camera snapping away at every second.
I'm going to tell my mum on my pager, and it's going to take me 10 minutes to type out this message. That's what it would have been for me.
Yeah.
Well, let me go to a payphone.
Yeah, by which point you would have died. But yeah, but there was definitely a freedom of expression and a freedom of curiosity when I was a kid. And even as a 20-something, I had that ability to say stupid shit. I still say stupid shit, to be quite honest. I still fuck things up quite regularly.
Me too.
There was a freedom of that happening and me not then having to worry that it would be sent round a group of WhatsApps, or it would suddenly appear on Snapchat, or it would be all over Instagram, or somebody would make a stitch of me and a reaction of me saying those stupid things. But that allowed me to develop and grow and make mistakes in a much safer environment. And I think there's definitely something when it comes to conversations I'm seeing online at the moment, particularly with men. And I want to kind of circle back a little bit more with your work that I've seen you talking about men's ability or how they can show up as themselves without fear of being called toxic, or how can they start to embrace their whole self, that authentic, unapologetic part of being a man and a male, and displaying masculine and feminine traits, and not feel that they're being labelled misogynistic if they make a mistake, or being labelled as an alpha or a beta, like, all of this terminology, these labels and these identities, particularly with men. I'm seeing men are really struggling with this stuff. Like women struggle yet, but I want to focus on men are struggling with this almost attack.
Yeah, I think that's a really important, actually, that you've just made, is that you know, I don't think this has to be a whataboutism thing. And I think that's actually contributes to the problem, that us versus them thing, because even when we're talking about feminist issues, for feminist issues to progress and things to get better from an equality standpoint, you need to involve men in the conversation, because they're as much part of the society as women are. But same as women can have masculine traits and display masculine qualities at times, and, you know, they're positive and negative on both sides. It is a strange time, and again, without getting the violins out, to be a man, because societally we don't really know what's expected of us. We don't know what's expected of, but also we don't really have the skill set for that either. So when we're talking about emotional granularity, and we're talking about communication from a male standpoint, we're not taught this stuff. You know, strength in speaking. Well, great, but I've never done that. Like, how do I do that? Oh, you know, you should talk to people how you better feel. I'm angry, but is it anger? Is it disappointment? Is it shame? Is it guilt? Because we don't know how to pinpoint those things, let alone articulate them and communicate them to someone else. But if I share that with the wrong person, that can be by from the alphas, in air quotations, that no one will see as well. That will be perceived as being weak. I'll be classed as a beta. I don't want to be too affair, because I've still got to be a protector. But I can't be so much of a protector, I'm angry all the time, and I'm seen as toxic. So there's all these really unhelpful descriptions around men that, you know, arguably we're trying to eradicate in women and the terminology that we use there, because I'm a stickler for language, and generationally that falls into different things. You know, like, for example, one of the wisest, I'm going to say wisest, men that I coach at the moment, he's 75, and he will say darling, he will say bird occasionally, but he's a product of his lifetime. He's not, he's not what I would class as a misogynist, but then would that be something I would teach to My son growing up now wouldn't teach him those things. It's moving with the times. But I don't think we should necessarily condemn men for how they are, but there's certainly a more helpful way in which we can address things. You know, men seen as aggressive in the gym towards women. Is it men being aggressive towards women in the gym, or is it just men and women are like that in a gym environment, you know, when it comes to shared equipment? You know, if I'm asking to use a piece of gym equipment after a woman, is that because I'm hassling that woman to use gym equipment? Or if there was a bloke there, would I just say, how many sets you got left, mate? You know, I think there's a slippery slope in which we can stick people into boxes and we can, judgment, I think, gets a bad rep. Judgment is there for good reason. It's there to assess risk from both standpoints, you know, and I think, unfortunately, part of that I will never be able to fathom. I've never walked through a dark car park worried about my safety. So from a male perspective, I could never relate from that standpoint. I've never felt in danger for my life in a room with one member of the opposite sex. So certain things that I think, you know, from both sides, we just need to be open to conversationally engage in these things a little bit more, but without being condemned. Again, making mistakes without being called a toxic man or an alpha or a beta, or, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, a conversation about vulnerability, especially I have with men, is they'll often call it oversharing. Is that we class just being honest as oversharing when, again, the language thing, how we categorize things. Why is societally, why do we think that just being honest and open is oversharing? Isn't that what you want from men? And again, it brings about more questions than actual answers, but it starts with conversation. But I was never taught those things. And again, it's that self-awareness thing. It's perhaps learnt the hard way, I think, where I was more of a classic man box type archetype in suppress that shit, mate. You know, push that stuff down. Just ignore it. It'll go away eventually. And then you end up a frustrated, angry person because you've never learnt how to express that, because we talk about safety from a female perspective, but safety for men as well, because we're not brought up in an environment where we can safely share those things.
So it's really, it's something that I've been super conscious of through several conversations I've had with other men. Normally on social media, actually, when I've posted something from a place of vulnerability for myself, I've had people reach out and say to me privately, it's not just women that deal with that. And I think because I'm quite open about people having different opinions, I think people feel that they can approach me and discuss these kinds of things in a safe-ish space. But it's such a conditioned thing, like you said, that you're not taught, you're not taken aside when you're at school and told, oh, by the way, this is how you communicate and engage with your fellow males if you've got a problem. But women also aren't taught, but we are genetically predisposed to be more social and we are more conversational. It is part of our DNA. It's part of the female makeup that we are. You can see it in studies in babies and kids that girls play in groups. Boys tend to be solo or in groups of one or two.
I don't buy into all of it, psychology, but there are certain aspects like that I do. Because, you know, from a logical standpoint, it does make sense. But I think what has been normalized, actually, and what makes a lot of men fearful about engaging in these conversations is that it is, and I'm really selective about the word I use here, more acceptable, I think, because we are challenging this narrative around how men wrongfully have treated women in the past. But modern men almost, and, you know, The patriarchy doesn't actually benefit modern men anyway. Let's get that straight. You know, it was a system created to benefit a certain type of man years ago, but modern men are being held accountable for that. So these conversations, this narrative around things like the patriarchy and men are trash, men are toxic, and taking the piss out of men for saying things like not all men. Again, it pushes men to a place of fear. They don't want to engage in these conversations because
it's problematic.
I don't want to have a conversation where someone with, for example, if, and this is the biases thing where I was talking about at the very start, if a woman has had particularly negative experiences with a man or many men over the years, she does have her biases built up. Now, if she goes online and she overtly expresses those. And I want to go, well, can I just give my input? Can I, oh, look, yeah, another hashtag not all men. I'm not going to engage in that conversation. So both sides, I think, have to be careful with who they engage in and how they engage with it. Because a lot of that language is just simply inflammatory, especially when, with regard to men, and the ways in which would not be acceptable, because I think it's important to acknowledge what's double standard sometimes, dare I say it, with regards, like, it wouldn't be acceptable, and rightly so, how men refer to some women. I think some women are now referring to some men about that way, but some men can't speak about that because that's not acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, there is definitely, there's definitely double standards. I had a discussion with my son, must have been about a month ago. He came, he's 20, nearly 21. He came home from a night at the pub. He'd just been to the local Witherspoons, classy joint.
That's what you do.
And he
age.
Came back and I picked him up. Yeah, I picked him up, and in the car on the way back, he said, I got groped at the bar by two middle-aged women. He said, and it wasn't just a bum squeeze. She full-on grabbed my balls. And I was like, oh, my God. I was like, that's awful. I was like, are you okay? And he was like, yeah, he's, I'm fine. He said, the security guard came over and asked me if I was okay and if I wanted to call the police about it. He was like, that was really, he said, I can't believe that happened. He was like, I actually felt that these things are being paid attention to.
Yeah, now.
He said, but those women, he said, they literally had no concept that what they were doing was out of order or assault or abuse.
Yeah.
And he said, if I'd have turned around, done that to them, I would be in a police cell right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, obviously that's horrendous that happened to him. And that's quite an extreme example. So especially like the genitals.
Yeah, but it's not surprising.
I'm not surprised. I'm just thinking about less so these days, definitely not these days as a married man, but perhaps in like younger years, and I guess most aspirational boys that are in the gym and looking to look a certain way and develop their chest, their arms, etc. It wouldn't be uncommon for a woman to go up to grope his chest, grope his arms, but roles reversed, it would be a very different conversation. But that's not just on women, I think that's on men as well. It's like, chill out, mate. You know, you've got a bit of a that's what a lot of men's attitudes that would be. So that would be confusing from the standpoint from a man or boy who hadn't had that conversation, wasn't aware that's unacceptable. If all the other men around you are like, it's no big deal, mate. Just, you know, crack on, get on with it. Let them do that. Oh, is that normal then?
Yeah. Yeah. But this is indicative of the changes that are happening, because 10 years ago, when women were out, it was accepted as the norm for men to grope your ass or to make a comment about you as you walk past. And it was almost brushed off as, oh, it means you're attractive. Don't make a big deal out of it. It's nice. It's something to be proud of.
You should be flattered.
But now that conversation has shifted. Yeah. And now men are experiencing that it's not acceptable for them, and they can say it's not acceptable. And when somebody says, oh, you know, like, you should be flattered. Hey, look, you've pulled, mate.
Catcalling happens to men as well.
That conversation. Yeah, that kind of conversation can now be changing to, are you okay?
Yeah.
Because that's all you need to ask is, mate, are you okay? That shouldn't have happened. That should not have been allowed. That's somebody invading your personal space in a way that makes you feel less than. Because it does. It's a very vulnerable, shaming behavior to do that.
It's the exchange of the power dynamic, and that essentially is, without making this too much of an extreme example, is, you know, rape, for example. You know, is it possible for a man to be raped? Well, yeah, of course it is. And this wasn't something I would have been aware of 10 years ago, because the physical acts in which things happen for a man are slightly different in certain scenarios. But also, I wasn't aware of that there's a lot of shame attached to women and rape, that their bodies have involuntary responses. They feel like they are part of it, that they somehow gave consent to it along the way. But again, no one's having these conversations. I think that, did you ever watch that? I spoke to you about it before, that Michaela Cole written drama that she, it was on BBC. I May Destroy
No, I didn't watch it.
And about how blurred and grey and really not talked about the lines of consent, sexuality, and different genders are. there's a lot to it, but stuff that I didn't know nothing about. Mm. And I'm still, you know, I'm still learning. And perhaps even this to onlooker or someone listening to his conversation. He's a bit of an effeminate bloke. Why is he talking about this stuff? What's that, you know, what, how's that relevant? How am I supposed to know if I've got no interest in it?
Yeah. It's such a, they're really interesting discussions, and you can never be certain or sure of where a conversation like this is going to go with somebody or what might be perceived by somebody on the outside. That's why I'm really intent on these conversations that I have. I'm not going to edit any of the conversations out. I'm asking questions as they come up in my head, and I want my audience to have a different perspective, and I would like people to challenge ideas and thoughts, but in a respectful way. And I think it's important that these conversations are made public, like to show that you can have a discussion around subjects that are tricky and emotive and icky, for want of a better word, because they're not pleasant to have.
Really, conversations
about consent.
I apologize if that's triggering to anyone listening. It's just what I'm much more in favor of these days is like honest connection. And that means not necessarily this defiant people claim that people have in this is just the way I am. But if I want people to get to know me, or, you know, I've been politely asked to come on here to talk about me and my experiences, my thoughts, my observations and certain things, because I'm not making any claims here. I don't claim to know it all, don't profess to know it all. I'm not saying everything I've suggested is right. Just observationally speaking, I'd rather it was a true reflection of who I am as a person and what I think, not a persona that someone might see on social media. Because I always find that's an odd claim. A really odd claim is you go to often special fitness events and it's, oh, so-and-so is exactly how they are online. It's, well, what's the expectation that they would be different? Or you do meet someone and they are totally different to their online persona because they've developed a persona or character they have to play up to. So if I'm going to get things wrong royally, I'm going to die on a hill that is representative of me as a person without
without
being misrepresented or anyone taking a clip of a conversation and, you know, putting their own spin on it. Yeah, I apologise for hijacking the conversation there.
Not at all, though. These are the kinds of things that I want to organically come from the questions that I ask. You just said fitness events, and I've got a question on my sheet that I was going to ask you, which is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question. But fitness events, are they actually worth attending for your average personal trainer or online coach? Or, controversial, are they just a pissing contest for the speakers? Present company excluded.
Can I say a bit of both, or is that a cop out? I think
you can say a bit of both because that's the nuance, the middle
maybe
ground,
the
unsexy
right? Grey. But I do think they've certainly improved from someone that's been going to them for 10 years or so, in which it was just a display of certain people come and fluff my ego, maybe a bit of a pissing contest. Well, you know, and on the objectification front, is I remember going to a fitness show with a brand I won't mention one year and being told to told to take my shirt off to stand on the stand, which I was just complicit with at the moment because that was the norm. And if that's the norm, you don't know any different, right?
Yeah,
but I can reflect on that now and think, oh my God, I can't believe that. Number one, that was asked of me. Number two, that I went along with that. That's ridiculous. So I'm not going to play victim here. But with the incorporation, and the other positive thing that I didn't get the opportunity to say about the fitness industry is the fitness industry is in the best place possible in that people are more educated than ever, people are more compassionate than ever, people are more empathetic and experienced than ever. Because going back 10 years or so, there were only really a few voices that were having the platform, so to speak, quite the extreme end, almost regurgitating their standpoint. Now there are lots more discussions about what I would consider the more important aspects. Yeah. The communication, the being more empathetic, the self-awareness, you know, actually real exploratory-based coaching, not just a set of explicit instructions, a prescription, do this and this will happen. Well, that,
manual.
Yeah, and I think that's the distinguishing part of fitness in which I think a lot of things that are called coaching aren't necessarily coaching because how I view coaching now has totally evolved over the years and actually getting to know someone and helping them understand themselves better and what they're capable of. And embracing behavior changes different to there are your macros, there's your training plan, see you in 12 weeks. That's not really coaching.
Yeah. And I've seen your evolution, if you like. How long have we known each other? Probably about 4 years.
A bit longer. I reckon a bit longer.
4 years. Yeah, maybe longer than that. And I can see your progression and your learning and how you're evolving as a coach. And I think that's just what it should be. That should be the norm and the standard, I think. When it comes to fitness events as well, this is something that's bugged me personally. And I've always wondered, why are fitness events only ever for fitness people? Why are they not put on to educate the general public?
I think that's a valid question, because realistically...
That's the whole point of having the industry.
And again, just not to defend it at all, but where things have improved, that improvement I've seen, not just from an educational standpoint and how people have improved the industry, but more messaging around fitness and health being accessible to all, because it is for everyone. It's not just for the elites. And I think for many years... it was the extreme end, the aesthetics end, that was put on that platform and glorified. I don't know, honestly, whether it's because my echo chambers changed or that is because the industry as a whole have changed, in honesty. Because I often have this conversation. It's like, have things improved or has my echo changed as I've evolved as well? Because I think
that's probably the middle ground as well.
Yeah, a bit of both. But you're exactly right. It should be more accessible to all. But I think that's in... location, cost, there's lots of conversations about various different things, how they're marketed, who they get to ask at those things as well, because I'm certainly not Insta famous enough. I don't know why I get asked in, honestly, because as a show I went to last year, but that involved a little bit of alcohol for many people, I was asked and reminded the question of, I've got more followers than you on Instagram. I'm like, okay, cool. Is that what we're getting? Is this the litmus test now, as you can only speak at these things if you've got a certain amount of followers?
I can name several cats that have like several million followers, but you wouldn't get them on stage to talk about something.
No,
would you?
And
that's how irrelevant a follower can be.
Yeah, it's a vanity metric. And I think there's still people that speak at certain events that I've been asked at those events because I understand these are things for a business as well. They need to sell tickets. They need to base that on people they think are popular and will sell tickets for them. But when you listen to their ideas, they're dated, their coaching practice, their views on things, and the ironic thing there is always some of their messaging revolve around personal growth, mindset, neuroplasticity, all these things, but you're talking about the same stuff you were talking about 10 years ago. There's no change here.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just but I wouldn't consider myself a businessman, so what do I know?
You are, because you have a business, therefore. It's like bikini bodies, right? If you are beach body, yeah, if you have a body and you're on a beach, therefore it's a beach body. You are a man, you have a business, therefore you are a businessman.
I guess, but I certainly wouldn't like profess to give anyone business advice from that standpoint, because I know I'm quite stubborn. Like, I will often cut my nose off despite my face, because I don't know whether it's age. I just refuse to play the game list. I can't be bothered with the game. And that's...
That's
the honest connection thing for me as well, is I don't want to misrepresent myself. If people want to choose to work with me, I want that because, you know, their values are aligned and they believe that I can help them, not on the basis that I have a certain coaching program or I've got a certain number of followers or I've done this number of photo shoots or bodybuilding competitions.
Yeah, or your best mates with someone.
But the other thing I find about talking sometimes about these things is that because I have got a much significantly smaller following, it can appear bitter when I think I've still hold the same opinions. I would, but I think the general consensus would be, he just sounds a bit bitter. Maybe it's because he hasn't got a blue tick. He thinks these things, but genuinely, those are my honest thoughts, I think.
But that's other people's perceptions, isn't it? And other people's biases. They would be, if that's how they think that you might be, that's a reflection on what their mindset is.
Yeah, possibly. Or possibly me articulating that is my own insecurities out loud anyway, is that I think people believe that.
Yeah.
But that's that thing about perception, right? And especially when we're talking about body images, it's sometimes nothing to do with the objective truth. It's what you think and feel about that truth.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's powerful. So how do you, Dan, maintain balance in your life? How do you keep all of your plates spinning? So running a successful business, being a committed husband and father and wanting to have an impact on the world. How do you balance those things?
I'm going to caveat everything I'm about to say and say I still struggle. I don't think it is balanced all of the time. Yep. But I also think that's a realistic expectation of yourself, is that sometimes you do fall out of balance when certain things take priority.
Yeah.
So if it was, you know, personal relationship suffering, or the arrival of my son was one yesterday, arrival of a new child this time last year, work wasn't a priority for me. It wasn't, because home life was a priority. And other times when certain events are coming up or I've got certain deadlines to meet, then it might be work. So balance is sometimes accepting that there is no balance some of the time, but I do have certain non-negotiables, and that revolves around physically and mentally taking care of myself in my version of that. And I, you know, this again, I think with the narrative around mental health, it's if you do this, it will fix that. Whereas I know what benefits me, which is taking time out to connect with real conversations, real relationships, journaling. We spoke a bit about writing and how writing and reading and writing helps you formalize your own thoughts a little bit more, but expand those thoughts as well. So you're not always stuck in a rigid mindset with those sort of things. Moving my body is huge, incredibly important to me. And I think what I've come to realize over the years, which is why my fascination with mental health, especially, and mental illness, is that they're so interconnected. There's no conversation about health if you're not addressing both of them, in that, you know, people that express problems with their mental health, that will manifest itself in the body in inexplainable ways, in which aches and pains, you know, a lack of motivation, lethargy, things like that. People get injured, they report their mental health suffering. So they're so interconnected. Is if we're talking about the mental, we have to address the physical, and vice versa.
Awesome. So do you think that there's definitely an element, as you get older, you feel more able to surrender to the fact you can't have it all, and you can't maintain balance in everything, and that's actually
okay. I think compromise is an important one, accepting there is compromise, and that's in line with what you value in life. So if with what you value, you can get your head around that being a compromise, that's far more acceptable, I think, than something you value and then sacrificing that. But again, like this, this is that societal programming, isn't it? And I think something which you're not necessarily aware of, less experienced, younger, whichever your phrase you want to use, is that often that's based on other people's expectations, other people's versions of success. It was almost, you have to go through that learning experience to go, I mean, earning that money would be great, but there's always more money to be, you know, what I've got now, I feel, is I perhaps don't work as many hours, but I have far better life work balance. There have been times in my life I've earned a lot more money and I have worked a lot more hours, but personal life has suffered. So it's from making mistakes as well.
Yeah. And being okay with making mistakes.
I'm a deeply flawed human. Yeah.
I think we all are. It's just some of us are a bit more okay with demonstrating and admitting and sharing that stuff. So what podcasts, books, or resources do you think everybody should read?
A very difficult one.
Just pick one.
Just one resource.
Either a podcast, a book, or a resource. Yeah. If somebody's really intent on improving their relationship with self, what would you recommend?
That's a tough one to give broadly. I would suggest, for me personally, and I know we've had a separate conversation about this, learning a little bit more about internal family systems in reference to parts of self, and more self-explanation. And that is from Richard Langley, whose research was originally into bulimia, or what would be now bulimia, and what would be more associated these days with binge eating. That actually has nothing to do with those in this particular instance and reference, in that there are certain behaviours and patterns of thought that we fall into that serve a purpose for us at certain points in our life. And it's easy to become trapped in those, that we carry them over into our adult lives. But having that introspection and that ability to reflect and not treat those parts like they're defective, not like they're broken, but accept they serve a purpose at a certain time, and almost learn to appreciate those flawed parts of ourselves has been pretty transformative for me, is what I would share.
Yeah.
Whether anyone else finds that helpful,
amazing.
Let me know.
That was internal.
Yeah, one of his books, which I would recommend, is called No Bad Parts.
No Bad Parts, Internal Family Systems. I'll make a note of that in the show notes. Lastly, where can people best contact you to find out more about your work?
Probably best Instagram, at the most forgettable Instagram handle ever, v.dan.osman. But if you search Dan Osman, there's not many of us. There was a very famous rock climber called Dan Osman, who was very good at rock climbing.
Did he fall off?
Yeah.
Oh dear. I shouldn't laugh about that. That's a terrible thing to laugh about. Who even am I?
It's fine.
It's the least compassionate, empathic response.
That's part of being human, though.
Cool. Thank you. It is. It's definitely part of being human. Awkward moment. Thank you so much for this conversation, Dan. I really appreciate you coming on. I love having challenging conversations and being able to share the nuance and the context, particularly with somebody like you. So I would only have a conversation like this with someone that I know there is an option for discomfort and that I could feel safe knowing that I might get it wrong or knowing that I might hear something that I disagree with, and it would be okay
Likewise,
for me to challenge and question.
I think that's an honest connection thing. I feel obviously we know each other personally, but very at ease having those conversations because there is no fear of repercussions. I don't think anything I've said is too, and maybe I'll reflect on that a later date and think, oh, I can't believe I said that, but I don't think I said. I do tend to try to think about what I say and how I say it. I don't think I've said anything too outlandish.
I don't think so either. We'll find out when it goes to life.
Dan Osman, cancelled.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me, Dan. You have just listened to the Conversations with a Coach podcast with me, your host, Tanya Filer. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the show notes for resources and links to previous episodes and the YouTube channel. Don't forget to share and tag on your social posts. And thank you for listening.